Okay. Once upon a time, feels a bit like. So, yes, actually, Shubha asked me quite a long time ago if I'd come and give a talk here as, you know, one of the speakers of the Buddhist elders. It's quite a title, that. And anyway, I wasn't able to do last year or early this year, and as it so happened, somebody cancelled, the Shokushu cancelled, who was supposed to be doing tonight quite recently, so I was able to step in at the last minute, which suited me quite well. So it's lovely to be here. I love coming to the LBC because this was my early Buddhist home. Okay, it's going to be, I don't know what, I've only listened to one of the other talks, so I don't know sort of how other people have done their sort of autobiographical Buddhist talks, but anyway, just take it as it comes. Perhaps I should just say a little bit of who I was before I met Buddhism, because I met Buddhism when I was 25 years old and I'm now 61. Very briefly, I had a relatively sort of what we might call happy, healthy upbringing with very loving parents. My father was a clergyman, Church of England clergyman. Was sent to boarding school, left school when I was 16, did a lot of travelling and various jobs travelling. I didn't want to sort of settle down in any kind of way. At some point, I think when I was about 21, I took up nursing. So I did a 3-year nursing course in London at the Middlesex Hospital, which has now been pulled down. When I met the FWBO, I will call it the FWBO, that's the Triratna Buddhist, what are we called? Order. community, yes. I would call it the FWBO because that's what it was in those days. I had actually just travelled overland to India, so this was in 1976, and I'd done one of those overland trips going through countries you wouldn't dream of going through now, like Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and into India. And possibly I was in search of something then, but hard to articulate that. I came back to England and I was moving to Cornwall, from London to Cornwall, to do a year's midwifery course because I wanted to sort of work in developing countries, probably with voluntary service overseas. So I'd moved to Cornwall. It was the very hot summer of 76. Some of you probably hardly born. Some of you will remember the hot summer. Down to Cornwall. And I really wanted to learn to meditate. On my travels in India, I'd met people who meditated. And I was interested in meditation. And on the notice board in the hospital where I was working, there were two posters. And one was for TM, Transcendental Meditation. And you had to pay something like £25. And the other one was Buddhist meditation, free. So you guess which one I took. And it was going to be led, it said, by a very exotic sounding name, Upasaka Manjuvajra. So I imagine this sort of really exotic Eastern kind of person. Actually, Manjuvajra was, you know, a pretty young order member with long hair and a long moustache and stripy sweater and sort of didn't fit the bill at all, but he was great. I believe that next week, Ratnavandana was giving the talk, and actually it was Ratnavandana who taught me to meditate in Cornwall, and she was a Mitra at that time. And the classes were run in a small room in a place in Truro, which was called the People's Palace. But this was a derelict, partially derelict building. You had to sign a form when you went in to say you went in there at your own risk. And I often think back at that and think, yeah, little did you know. I was only interested in meditation. I knew nothing about Buddhism. So what we used to do in those classes was we'd meet in this upstairs room. There was a little table with a little Buddha on it and cushions put out. And we'd meditate for maybe 40 minutes, maybe that long. And you know, nobody ever taught me how to sit, and you know, I was sort of in agony. And then we'd have a tea break, and then we'd listen to these tape lectures by this man called Sangharakshita, who, of course, I have no idea who he was. And those lectures were the Noble Eightfold Path lectures. So the first lecture I ever heard was that of Perfect Vision. And anyone who's listened to that series of lectures, you know, it was very, very sort of transforming stuff that he was saying. And it was, I mean, this probably sounds a cliche, but it was very, I had very much the sense of coming home. What Sangharakshita, who's Bhante, who is the founder of our order, was saying in those lectures, it was as though, sort of as though it resonated something really deep within, and sort of things that I kind of believed in, but sort of seemed to take me so much further, but I would never have articulated for myself. So we'd listen to those lectures, and then we'd go down the pub. Which was great, and it was a very small group. There were maybe 5-6 people would come along with she who is now Ratnavandana, because she was leading those. This sort of exotic name, Manjivajra, he had set up this little group in Cornwall, but in fact he was helping here build Suparvati. And because I was doing my midwifery course and sort of working shifts and things, I couldn't always make the weekly class. So the weeks I couldn't make, I asked if I could borrow the tape and take it home, and I'd listen to it rather sort of secretively, because I wasn't sure what some of my other friends might think. And I also remember setting up a little shrine, not with a Buddha image, but sort of setting up a candle and lighting a stick of incense and sort of meditating. About 6 weeks after my first class, I went on my first weekend retreat down in Cornwall. And that was the first time I met Manjivajra, who was a great guy. And this was out in a little cottage in Cornwall. And I did my first puja, and probably many of you would have done sevenfold pujas. I was completely thrown in at the deep end, so it's a devotional practice. Nobody kind of explained anything, and I certainly wasn't going to hold my hands like that before a graven image. Yes, I wouldn't bow, and I obviously didn't want to say sort of words that I didn't know what they were meaning. But I remember at the end of that first puja, sort of sitting on afterwards and feeling I could hardly get up off my cushion, and that wasn't just for aching knees and things, it was because, you know, again, sort of something had struck quite deep in a sort of core of me, which I didn't really know what it was, but I knew I wanted more of it. And I remember driving back to where I lived in another part of Cornwall, and I could hardly drive. I was probably only driving about 20 miles an hour, and every so often I had to stop the car and sort of get out and then sort of get in again and drive, because something sort of was kind of going on, was shifting sort of states of consciousness or something were happening to me. I can't really explain it. And I knew that whatever this Buddhism was about, I wanted it, and I wanted more. After my first, maybe second weekend retreat, we were doing some study on the five precepts, and so just hearing more about the first precept, you know, with deeds of loving kindness I purify my body and abstention from killing anything, I realised, how could I possibly eat meat or fish anymore? And I remember just becoming a vegetarian overnight, and I used to actually quite like meat and fish, you know, I just quite like the taste, and but it was just sort of, how on earth could I do that and sort of look at the lambs, you know, dancing around in the field and then kind of eat them? So, you know, I became a vegetarian, as I say, overnight. I remember I went to one wedding party about 2 months later and had a bit of chicken or turkey, I can't remember, and that was it, and, you know, never had any since then. And I think that was the same, actually, for most people in those early days. You know, people just did become vegetarian very kind of quickly. And vegetarian food wasn't very available outside. I mean, obviously you could cook your own, but in restaurants and things, there wasn't much vegetarian food. So I got very involved with the FWBO really very quickly. And we started a community in Cornwall of men and women. And we were four adults, three children, two dogs and one cat. And we moved into the other woman's house. So Rita had the three children, yeah. And her marriage had sort of dissolved, and she had this beautiful house, so the rest of us just kind of moved in and set up this Buddhist community, which was lovely, and I wanted more. This was a bit of a refrain in those early days. I always wanted more than what seemed to be kind of on offer. We all had different jobs and went out to work, and I was doing various midwifery jobs. In the summer of, I suppose it must have been 77, I went on my first large retreat up country, as they say in Cornwall. So it was a school somewhere in the West Country. And that retreat was led by Loka Mitra, who some of you will have heard of, who was very instrumental in setting up our activities in India and still lives out in India. He's an Englishman. So I'm going to sort of names drop a bit because a few of you will know who the people are and others just sort of let it wash over you. But anyway, Loka Mitra was leading the retreat, Surita was leading yoga, and Padmapani was in the kitchen. There were no women ord members, no Dhammacharinis on that retreat because it was the same time that Amaravati, a large women's community, was being set up in East London. However, there were two other women Mitras, because I was a Mitra by this time. Was I a Mitra? I think, I'm not sure. On that retreat, and I believe they've both given talks. One was Vajrapushpa, and the other was Sri Devi. So they were both on that retreat, and we sort of formed a bit of a friendship. And on that retreat, Bhante Sangharakshita came down from wherever he came from, actually in Norfolk probably, and there was an ordination of a Finnish man, Sava Mitra, on that retreat. So it was the first time I'd met Bhante, seen Bhante, and obviously it was very special having an ordination on this big open retreat. Bhante had very long hair, very bad wonky teeth. He was wearing his robe, and I seem to remember it's a hot summer day, and he had this sort of thick sweater on underneath his robe, which he often seemed to have. Yes, I didn't really obviously know quite what the ordination was all about, but again, it had an impact on me. It was probably a few months after that summer retreat that I went on my first women's retreat. This was the era of very much of the sort of, call it the sort of segregation of the sexes. And I know, because I've listened to Vajrapushpa's talk on tape, so those of you who've been here, I know she sort of talked quite a lot about that time. I don't really want to say a lot about it, except to say that, you know, women were very much encouraged to go on women's events and men were very much encouraged to go on men's events. So I was a little resistant to going on women's retreats, but I was told, well, I've asked to be a Mitra, so, you know, maybe you kind of should go on a women's event. So this retreat was being held at our first women's retreat centre, which was called Mandarava, which was in Norfolk, in the country Norfolk. It's the middle of winter, it was Christmas retreat. It was bitterly cold, and we had these paraffin heaters in the shrine room. I was pretty miserable, I have to say. I'd been to an all-girls boarding school, and there was a sense on this women's retreat of the worst, from my perspective, the worst aspects of women being together. Now, this is a terribly subjective view, but this is what I felt. I felt that quite a lot of kind of cliqueiness and groupiness. and I hated it. And I had asked to be a Mitra before I went on that retreat, and by the end of the retreat I wasn't sure that I wanted to be a Mitra. I felt that if I had to sort of spend an awful lot of time in this kind of environment, I didn't want to do it. My experience in Cornwall was very, very different from that. At the end of that retreat, which was in Norfolk, I went to visit Bhante for the first time at Padmaloka. So that was, you know, a bit down the road, maybe 15, 20 miles away. Although I'd seen him at that ordination, this was my first sort of one-to-one meeting with him. And he was very much encouraging me to move. Well, I myself had been thinking I wanted more. The only way to get more was to move out of Cornwall, and there were two places where the main centres were, and one was in London and the other was in Norfolk. And I really didn't want to go back to London at that time, so sort of Norfolk was my option. But then I was having this experience of this women's retreat, which I really wasn't sure I wanted. And I remember sitting in Bhante's study and saying, you know, I was sort of trying to convince him that I didn't want to move, and I was sort of saying, oh, well, Cornwall's so beautiful, and da-da-da-da-da. And he said, ah, yes, but Norfolk has the skies. And at that moment, I looked out of his study window, and there's this incredible sunset, sort of as though he'd conjured it up going across the skies. I talked quite a bit with Bhante at that time about India, because I'd already heard of, probably through Lokamitra, who had been leading the big retreat, about setting up FWBO activities in India and the need for social projects going alongside the Dharma teaching. So I talked to Bhante about that. It was the first time that I'd heard sort of the name of Dr. Ambedkar. I'm not going to say anything about that. Some of you will know a lot about that and the sort of former untouchables. Bhante was very, very encouraging, because I was sort of saying, you know, this is something maybe I could involve myself with, because my own sort of trajectory was going in such a way that I was, you know, I trained as a nurse and then was training as a midwife to eventually go and work somewhere in the developing world. I had actually already been offered a job by Voluntary Service Overseas in Malawi. I was about to accept it. I'd gone for my interview thing, I'd been accepted. And then there was this whole possibility of actually working with other Buddhists in our movement in India. So I wrote to VSO and said I didn't want the job. I had to pay my £20 train fare because I'd turned down the job, because I knew that at some time I'd rather be working with Buddhists, sort of people who had the same values. But then I was in a dilemma. So my experience of that women's retreat was, I'm not sure that I can sort of do this. You know, and then I had a few friendships in Cornwall, but there wasn't a lot of activity going on there. But then something really great happened for me was that I was driving back from Norfolk all the way down to Cornwall to sort of think, you know, do I want to be a Mitra? What do I want to do with my life? And I gave a lift to Marlini, who's an order member, Dhammacharini Marlini, who had been living at that Mandarava retreat centre but hadn't been on that retreat. And she and I hit it off really, really well. And she was going down to Cornwall to do a solitary retreat in a neighbouring caravan in the neighbouring field to where I was living. So I was living in one caravan, she lived in the other. She was going to do this solitary retreat. And I think she spent most of her 3-week or 4-week solitary retreat, we were in and out of each other's caravans. So she was the first sort of real woman friend that I had in the movement. And she's still a close friend today, even though she lives in New Zealand. Now, I've had sort of, you know, I've had a lot of friends sort of in life, you know, school friends, sort of early childhood friends, school friends, and I suppose they came and they went, and as probably they do for many of us when we're growing up. And I had one good friend, Judith, a nursing friend, and we travelled around quite a lot together. But where it's completely different with Marlene is we talked about sort of things that really were sort of meaningful to us. Whereas with my other friends, we had good times or did sort of enjoyable things together. But we didn't particularly talk about what was really sort of essential in our lives and our beings. And Marlene is a great person for sort of drawing. She was a great person to draw me out and sort of ask me, you know, what I felt about certain things, and very, very open about herself. I might say that Marlene was an order member. She was ordained when she was 19, mm-hmm. and she was ordained in the second batch of order members ever ordained. I became a Mitra, still down in Cornwall. Marlene was still there. Manjivadra came down. I became a Mitra. And because of the friendship developing with Marlene, I decided actually I would move up to the Mandarava Retreat Centre. Because she was living there and I felt, well, you know, just give it a try. Mandarava was a pretty funky old farm. It was owned by somebody who's an order member now, but she was a Mitra. She's now called Varaprabha. It was probably about 10 or 15 miles into Norwich, and there was a Buddhist centre in Norwich. So I was really excited about going to a Buddhist centre, because we hadn't got anything like that in Cornwall. We just got a small Buddhist group. However, again, I was rather disappointed, because we drive out from Mandarava, and I'll tell you who else lived at Mandarava. Some of you will know Ratnashuri, who lives at Taraloka now. And Ratnashuri lived there. She was called Beryl at that time. And Beryl had a three-wheeler car, and she was a terrible driver, so we used to call her Beryl the Peril. And we used to drive in her car, I think, to the Norwich Buddhist Centre. But this was still when the genders were very sort of separated. And there were a lot of men living in Norwich, and we sort of women would come out from the sticks and sort of come into the Norwich Buddhist Centre. And all these guys were sitting, it felt like this in a moment, sitting around the edge. It felt a lot like walking into a dentist's waiting room. And sort of nobody talked to you. You know, far from feeling I'd kind of come home, I felt, oh no, you know. Again, what's going on? But there was something about the Dharma that I couldn't let go of. Marlene and I continued our friendship, obviously living together with others at Mandarava. And, you know, when I look back, probably she and I were probably a bit cliquey, because we had a closer friendship than with others living in that community. Yes, we all did different work, and I was doing some agency nursing. So I lived at Mandarava for maybe 18 months or so. And then I moved to the London Buddhist Centre, and I moved here the opening week of festivities of the LBC. And I'd come down here again because I wanted more. And I'd met Subhuti somewhere up in Norfolk, and those of you who know Subhuti, he's extraordinarily encouraging. And he was sort of saying, well, why don't you come to the LBC and, you know, help out running a soup kitchen or something for all the festivities. So I came down here, not knowing what my future was going to be. And this is very much sort of how a lot of us were in those early days. We just sort of threw our lot in. I worked some of the time at the London Chest Hospital, if that's still down the road. I worked part-time there. I also worked part-time in one of our Right Livelihood, well, they were called co-ops then, businesses, which was a second-hand shop, sort of knick-knacks with Bill Del Monte, which one or two people may remember. I lived in a community in Bishop's Way, which was called Beulah. And Beulah, like many of the communities at that time, was a legal squat. I can't honestly remember what it meant to be a legal squat, but basically, you know, we were squatting it, but we were paying a tiny bit of rent. I remember we paid £4 each a week to live there. Huge house. But it was freezing, obviously no central heating or anything like that. The bathroom was semi-outside, which was lovely in summer and terrible in winter. So here I was, the LBC had opened, and I knew that at some point I certainly hoped that I would be going to live and work in India. I went for a walk around Victoria Park with Subhuti, who was the chair of the LBC at that time, and I was sort of saying, well, I don't mind doing a bit of this and that until I go to India, and probably I need a bit more sort of nursing training for what I want to do in India. And he was sort of saying, well, there's all this possibility of setting up a vegetarian restaurant, and probably learning about nutrition that way would be more help in the slums in India. And now, it wasn't very convincing. However, that is what I ended up doing. So myself and several others set up, well, what you probably knew as the Wild Cherry, but it was called the Cherry Orchard before that. And I became the first manager of the Cherry Orchard. And so I lived and worked with Buddhist women, and it wasn't so bad. I particularly, and I'd still say this till today, I particularly enjoy working with women. Living always feels a little bit more difficult for me for some reason. I think sort of one of the things about living is, in those days, just anybody who wanted to live in a community, if there was a space, you'd sort of take them in. I think people are a bit more cautious these days, and I think that's probably wise. You know, I think we were incredibly idealistic. And of course, yeah, you know, if you're interested in Buddhism, yeah, come and live together. But that really didn't always work. Marlene also moved at some point from Mandarava down to the LBC, and she also lived in that same community. And, you know, that it carried on sort of me feeling, well, I think probably both of us, me feeling I could talk about anything with Marlene, sort of openly and freely. And in a way, with some of the other, particularly sort of order members, when you're a mitra, I sometimes felt a little bit more hesitant in what I felt that I could say with others, but that was never the case with Marlene. I could speak about my doubts, my questions, and she would speak about her doubts, which sort of, possibly some of them, I don't know whether she should have done or she shouldn't, but she did. And actually I found that very, very refreshing. And I always looked up to her. There was, you know, definitely a slight vertical friendship there. She might be a year older than me, but you know, she'd been in the order, she'd got a lot more experience, she'd got a lot more wisdom than I had. I was a bit more streetwise, but she had a maturity beyond her years, actually. So around the LBC, and I'd say in the movement at large in the sort of late 70s, particularly with the opening of the London Buddhist Centre, there was huge amounts of sort of energy and enthusiasm. You know, people were just giving up their jobs to throw in their lot with Buddhism, with the Dharma, with the FWBO. It was a very, very exciting time. And, you know, I find it also quite liberating. There was a lot of commitment from people. We used to use that word a lot, commitment. Bhante had given the lectures, the New Society lectures, and you know, I really recommend those if you haven't listened to them, where he was talking about what became coined the three C's, communities, centres and co-ops. We couldn't carry on with our right livelihood businesses being co-ops because it sort of didn't quite fit. You know, with co-ops you couldn't say no to people who weren't Buddhists. But, you know, that's what a lot of us were doing. And, you know, I suppose in those lectures what Bhante was trying to say was we are trying to kind of create a new society within the existing society, or a new society within the old society. So there's a great sort of ferment of ideas and ideals and experimentation. And some of it was a bit wacky, I have to say. We were all very young. When I look back, we were a very, very youthful movement, the FWBO. We were all, practically all, in our 20s and 30s. So, you know, I'm only about sort of 27, 28 by this time. People like Subhuti was 30, 31, but he seems sort of much older than that to me. Banti, I worked out, was probably only in his late 40s, you know, which is extraordinary when I think about it, because obviously there's a huge, seemed to be a huge sort of gulf between most of us and then Banti, not only because of his, obviously, spiritual experience, but also sort of age-wise. So around the LBC, the Pure Land Cooperative was set up. So these all the different businesses, and there were many businesses around here at that time. There was a restaurant, there was a whole food shop, there was a printing press, there were second-hand shops. What else was there? I think there were...
Designers.
Windhorse designer, Windhorse photo setters, they were called, yeah. And the profit from all those businesses went to funding the centres, the LBC, and obviously putting on Dharma classes, which I think were all free at that time. Individually, I mean, I can't speak for others, but I felt very potent. Actually, I felt really we could do what we liked, and you know, we really could create this new society within the old society, and spread the Dharma. An interesting thing, sort of being a woman around the movement at that time, was, you know, Banti was, obviously he was the founder of our order and our movement. He was also a role model for people, but obviously that's pretty difficult for a woman. You know, one's never going to be like Banti. And anyway, he's such a very particular character. You know, so we didn't have our own role models, and even though there were women like Marlene and people you'll know like Dharma Dinner and Malika and people like that who've been around the movement longer than I had, and I could look up to as great teachers, but not entirely sort of role models. You know, there wasn't anybody who was that much older. Yeah. And for me, I have to say, you know, that none of the women sort of around at that time sort of I felt were sort of great leaders. There were great teachers amongst them, and some absolutely impressive and, you know, people with huge dedication, but there weren't people I could sort of model myself on, which I'm not sure is a good thing to do anyway. And in retrospect, you know, looking back over many years, I think actually that was quite healthy. I didn't have to be like somebody else. I could just be myself. But at that time, sometimes one felt, oh, I wish there was sort of somebody, you know, the guys can go and live with Banti if they like. Well, actually, I think, you know, a lot of them had a really difficult time doing that. But, you know, for me at that time, I sort of felt a bit disappointed. I think that probably I probably still am, slightly more on the individualistic end of the spectrum. If you've got sort of the individualist on one side and there's a group member, I'm probably more on the individualistic side of the spectrum. I carried on having friends outside the movement, which quite a lot of people didn't. I mean, maybe because they didn't have particular friends anyway. And I have to say that, you know, one or two of my non-Buddhist friends seemed rather more sane than some of my Buddhist friends. Sorry. And I suppose this became a bit of a koan for me. You know, here are my spiritual friends making huge amounts of effort, throwing in their lot, making a lot of spiritual commitment, very, very sincere. And yet some of them seemed a bit screwed up and sort of a heaviness sometimes. And some of my other friends seemed happier, healthier, more fun-loving outside the movement. And but I still knew that the Dharma spoke to me more, and actually that was what I was going to follow. So it's very interesting. And of course, a lot of those friendships, you know, now 35 years later, you know, are really, really strong friends. And we've all grown and we've all developed and we've all changed and we've all made terrible mistakes, and we're all still there. And I was reflecting kind of a few days ago when I knew I was going to give this talk, and I was thinking, well, what, you know, so, you know, some of my friends were quite happy and healthy, and maybe still are, non-Buddhist friends. And they probably don't sort of know about the Lakshanas, you know, the teaching of the three Lakshanas, that things are impermanent, insubstantial, unsatisfactory. This is the way things are. I mean, this is very much a Buddhist teaching. And I suppose, you know, life, in a way, as particularly as we grow older, sort of life teaches us that. And I think some of my non-Buddhist friends sort of do know that. But I think Buddhism sort of gives me a way to deal with that, which maybe some of my other friends don't actually have a way to deal with impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and insubstantiality. Right. And yes, I've kept up with one friend of mine, Judith. So this was a nursing friend, I think I mentioned her. And, you know, she's someone who I really feel is a friend for life. And strangely, she's now lives in Cambridge, where I live. Never been a Buddhist. So it's a parallel path, and you can't help sometimes kind of comparing. I don't think comparison is a very good or helpful thing necessarily to do. But it's sort of, you know, hers is a bit kind of the path mine might have been if I had not chosen the path of the Dharma. So, you know, she had a husband, she had kids, the marriage broke up, she had various other relationships, she was a social worker, she is a social worker, she had various new partnerships. She's done really, really well. She's got quite a lot of money. I'd say she's got quite a lot of mundane contentment now. And then I was thinking, well, you know, so my life might have gone along with some of that. And then what is my life? I don't want to say what hers is, because I think she's sort of all right in it, in a way. And I just think that sort of my life is rich and meaningful. I have a network of friendships with people who hold the same values as myself. And that's kind of worldwide, and I can step into, you know, a sangha in another country. I do travel a bit, and say I go to the Low Countries, Holland and Belgium, and I can go there and I can meet friends and mitras and order members, and I immediately can feel totally at home with them because of that sort of those same shared values. I think sort of for Buddhists, and for myself, there is something of the beyond. It's the beyond the mundane. It's very difficult to articulate. Maybe beyond the self, beyond self-clinging. There's an aspiration in my life. And sometimes, particularly I experience this on retreats, a sense of consciousness being so much bigger than sometimes I experience it in my day-to-day life, which brings about real freedom. Not just a sort of a secondary freedom that one might have if you had a lot of money and could go on nice holidays and things, which might bring certain freedom, but actually it feels very limited. Okay, 1980, I was ordained. These days we have a whole sort of long ordination training. I just got a letter from Bhante. I had asked for ordination. I got this letter from Bhante saying, the order members who know you well feel that you're ready to be ordained. I'm holding a seminar in 3 weeks' time. I do hope you'll come and we'll ordain you then. So that was sort of as much as I got. We didn't really get feedback. I probably did get feedback, but I did, you know, the word feedback didn't really exist in our vocabulary. I'd met Bhante on several occasions before my ordination. There was that first visit in Norfolk. I met him a number of times here, when he'd visit here or was living here at different times. My early days with Bhante, up to my ordination and quite a long time afterwards, actually I felt very at ease with him. And even on occasion, I challenged him, which sort of I look back and think, that was interesting. I remember challenging him because I remember when we were running the cherry orchard, sort of message got through from somebody else that the women who were working in the cherry orchard looked rather untidy And when I went to see Banti, I said, why didn't you just say that to me rather than sort of do it second and third hand? I can't remember his answer, but anyway, I had the kind of relationship with Banti that I could be sort of quite frank, and I think he was always quite frank with me. He was, as he was for everybody in those days, both my private and public preceptor, except we didn't have the word preceptor in those days, just Banti ordained everybody. He gave me the name Padmasuri. Padma means the lotus, and Shuri means heroine. And he talked about it in terms of the Padma being the more traditionally feminine qualities of spiritual unfoldment, spiritual development, and Shuri being the more traditionally masculine qualities of pioneering, heroic, outgoing, adventurous. And, you know, this is brought together in the one name. And I have to say, when he gave me that name, I felt very, very seen. And over the years, over the decades, that name has become quite a sort of teaching, a blessing, a bit of a koan. There have been times in my life when I felt that the shuri, the sort of heroic aspect, has had a lot of rain, and maybe the lotus was a bit wilting. But I think in more recent years that's been quite redressed the balance. I took up the meditation practice on Green Tara, who is the quintessence of compassion. And it wasn't as though I had a very, very strong feeling this is the meditation I wanted to do, but it was around the time of my ordination. I had a nephew who was born with, he was born with something called Fallot's tetralogy, which basically his heart was all back to front, and he did actually die when he was about 18 months old. And all that was kind of going on around the time of my ordination. And I just remember building a little shrine in my room in Bishop's Way, and just putting Tara, she seemed the most obvious figure to sort of have around me at that time. And when I said in my ordination to Banti that I wanted to take up the Green Tara practice, he said, ah, good, yes, the something like the Bodhisattva of compassion. But of course, she also represents wisdom. And I don't think I'd ever sort of taken that in, but those of you who know the figure of Tara, sort of seated Tara, the one leg is stepping out into the world, the sort of compassionate activity, but the other leg is up on the lotus flower and is still. So sort of you only do the activity out of the stillness of wisdom. So it's the wisdom and compassion coming together. Very shortly after my ordination, I went on a month's solitary retreat in Wales. And I'd say that most sort of order members from my era would go on month's solitary retreats probably, you know, once a year or so. So it's certainly sort of 2 or 3 week retreats. It was very common. When I came back from that, you know, I got sort of immersed in the LBC. I was only just back from my ordination almost. I was on the LBC council. I was part of the managers, Pure Land business managers meeting. Around 81, I think it was, so there were all these different businesses. Yeah, one of the businesses was called Friends Building Service. And the manager of that was somebody who was then called Bob Jones, who later became Vajrakhetu. And Vajrakhetu and I, around this time, got into a relationship. And that was rather looked down on in those days, because I was an order member and he was just a mitra. It was sort of what seemed to be all right the other way around, that women mitras could go with men order members, but that way around. Anyway, I was obviously onto something good, because 30 years later we're still together, although we'd never actually cohabited. The LBC just had some brilliant teachers and speakers. You know, I just remember so many of the classes coming and hearing these wonderful Dharma talks. The Sangha was very vibrant, very alive. And into the midst of all that, we had our first death of an order member, Vangisa. Vangisa actually was a bit older than most, well, quite a bit older than most of us. But he still wasn't so old. Maybe he was around 50 and he died suddenly. And I think that was a big sort of shock and a wake-up call for many of us. And I remember the funeral his body being brought in here in a coffin, having it sort of the body in the coffin. And he was somebody who had, you know, a wife who was non-Buddhist and two young boys. Well, they were sort of teenagers. And I just remember one of the sons standing up in the funeral and playing on his recorder Yesterday from the Beatles, and oh God. And I think that sort of, Vangisa's death somehow brought a different sense of reality into sort of our slightly euphoric kind of ways of being at that time. Well, it did me. I must move on. In 1982, I went out to India. So that sort of trajectory that had started continued. And I spent much of the next 9 years in India. I couldn't always live in India all the time because there were visa restrictions were brought in. I went out there mainly to do social work, working in the slum areas, doing a mother and child health clinics with an English doctor, Vera Badra. All the other Westerners working in India at that time were men. And Vajraketu, who was, you know, then my acknowledged partner, also was out there for a while. He and I had to keep our relationship under wraps. It was kind of considered, well, you know, in Indian culture and society, you know, if you're not married, not quite sure what people would think about it and so on and so forth. But, you know, that was, it was probably a bit difficult to keep it under wraps, but also having clandestine meetings rather enhances a relationship, so it probably had the converse effect of sort of non-attachment. After about 2 or 3 years of being in India, Vajraketu came back to India, visa restrictions were brought in, and actually he could never get back into India. So we very much had a very long distance relationship then over many, many years. And he was a great letter writer. We had no phones, no emails or anything in India, but that kind of relationship continued. As you said in your introduction, I have sort of written about my time in India in a book, so it's sort of quite a bit of it's documented there. But I'll just say a few things about working in India. After sort of probably a year or 2 years of doing mainly social work, it was just so obvious when we had retreats in India. So Lokamitra was the main sort of instigator of sort of doing lots of retreats and things, that you might have, you know, retreats for 100 people, 95 of them were men and 5 would be women. And so it's so clear that separate Dharma activities were needed for the women. And although I was sort of young in age and very inexperienced in doing any kind of Dharma teaching, I actually found myself giving public talks, leading retreats. The first retreat I ever led, 40 women turned up on, you know, and I'd hardly ever led a puja before. But, you know, I just got on with it. And again, it's very interesting looking back, people often say to me, God, how did you do all that? Well, I think it's just, I just did the next thing that was kind of in front of me and you just did it. I could function in both worlds. I could function in the West, I could function in India. But it definitely brought out very different things in me. India very much challenged my own cultural conditioning. Things like a personal space just don't sort of happen in India. Any of you who've travelled to India just know that, know what it's like. In the West, the whole sort of gender issue and debate, which I know Vajrapusha has talked about, maybe others have talked about, was going on. And to some degree, it was a real relief to just sidestep that and be in India, where, interestingly, you know, the segregation of the sexes is just sort of a very natural thing. And, you know, if we talked here about sort of women being repressed, my goodness me, you know, in India, one really saw what repression was about. I was around the age of 34, so I've probably been 2 or 3 years in India, when I went into what I call the baby dilemma. I had always assumed that I would have children at some time in my life. I was in this relationship with Vajra Ketu. He very much didn't want children. I really did, or thought I did. And I kept thinking, well, how much of his not wanting children was FWBO conditioning? How much of it was really him not wanting? I had, you know, a very painful time. I actually talk about this a little bit in my book, although I think it's only about a paragraph. And I felt that, you know, I really had to make a choice here. In a way, I was choosing, because obviously I could finish my relationship with Vajra Ketu, possibly find somebody else, have a child. But that seems so abstract. You know, when you're in love, and I was in love with Vajra Ketu, I probably still am. You know, that just sort of seems abstract and odd. And then I had this sort of thought, well, if I didn't have children, would I really regret it? Would I get to the age I am now and really regret that I hadn't done it? So I felt very, very alone. And of course, I didn't feel that I could really talk in any meaningful way with any of the Indian women. I mean, for them, they just have child after child. And well, of course, why not? But because I was a Buddhist, my choices had to be very, very conscious. I couldn't just sort of slip into, oh, maybe just sort of falling pregnant kind of thing. Vajra Pushpa, who some of you will know from her talk here, had her first child around the time that I was going through the height of my baby dilemma, and we'd write to each other. And I would write to Banti about my dilemma, and he was sympathetic. But I really wasn't sure how much he really understood. How could he? He wasn't a woman. But then there's the whole sort of teaching of, you know, the Buddha. And actually having a family clearly would restrict, you know, a lot of what you could do probably for many, many years. Yes, 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 I'd say to myself. But, you know, it's quite different being a Western woman and da-da-da-da. So, in the end, I decided I wouldn't go ahead and have children, and that's been the case. And about 8 years ago, when I was sort of firstly menopausal, I thought, right, now's a good time to look back and do a retrospective. And I did that, and I wrote quite a long article for Shabda, our order magazine. You know, going back to that question, would I have regrets when it was too late? And sort of I came down on the side of, well, life is full of regrets. And I think a lot would depend on what I had done in the intervening years. So I think if I'd looked back and I felt that I had wasted, so-called, the intervening years, I'd be really regretful that I hadn't had children. But I really felt that I really feel that what I've done, kind of, for myself, for the order, for the movement, has been fine, and I feel quite happy. And, you know, I see my friends, obviously my generation now, all becoming grandmothers and things. I think, well, that's really nice, but I don't actually have to have them. And there's always children around one can look after if I really want to, which I really don't these days, actually. Although I would have done then. If I had not had the Dharma, so to speak, it would have been a very natural choice for me to have children. And I think it's every woman has to decide for themselves. I wasn't someone who was greatly career-minded, so it wasn't as though, I know some women go down that path, I wasn't sort of someone who had that. But I do feel now that I've had sort of a great freedom to do what I want to do in my life, and I still am in that state. I went on a 3-month solitary retreat in New Zealand about 10 years ago. I've been leading the 3-month Vikarshivana ordination courses. I don't think I could do all that, even now if I got children, even if they were children who were leaving home. I'm sure I could do it once, but I wouldn't want to do it year after year. So there's many things. Interestingly, I still have a mother, so sort of family the other direction. I have a 99-year-old mother who lives in Cambridge. She lives in a care home. And actually, I've sort of been looking after her for the last sort of 8 or 9 years. And it's interesting because she's not probably nearly as endearing as a little baby would be who was growing up. But, you know, I have my responsibilities and I want to fulfil them till the end. In 1987, Bante asked me if I would ordain one of the two first women to be ordained in India, which was a great honour. I was only in the order about 8 years at that time. And, it was a very great honour to do that. Right, better move on a bit, because it's getting near to the end of time. When I would come back to England from India, because there was a time with the visa restrictions that I could only spend 6 months of the year in India, and I'd come back, there were a group of us who decided we wanted to move away from the LBC and start up sort of activities elsewhere. So myself, Ratna Darkini, some of you might know, Jaya Prabha and Vajra Pushpa, and I moved to Cambridge. Ratna Darkini and I living together, Vajra Pushpa with her two young children, and Jaya Prabha, who was single and later went to work in Germany. So we did that. Early 1990s, I wrote But Little Dust. So I had sort of about 6 months when I was writing that book. I don't think I'm particularly a writer, but it, in a way it was a way of... I suppose sort of integrating and sort of understanding some of that experience in India. So I sort of wrote that and then I put it down. And there's a bit of fiction within that as well. Then I came back to England sort of full time, mainly because I'd gone to India as a young person and as a young order member. And I felt I wanted to come back to my Buddhist roots, which in a way were more in England. So there I was in Cambridge. Vajra Ketu had moved to Cambridge. He was by this time the managing director of Windhorse Evolution. I moved there, I became the Mitra convener, started community living again, and got very back into sort of a very full-on idealistic lifestyle, living and working with other Buddhist women. Interesting when you think of my early experiences of really not liking women. By this time, I really, really enjoyed living with women. I worked in the evolution shop in Cambridge over a number of years and really enjoyed simple chores. I love teamwork. I really, really enjoy teamwork. And I think all my longest standing friendships in the order have been with people I've either lived or worked with. To varying degrees of sort of closeness with them over many, many years. One of the things I noticed when I came back to England that I was suddenly what people used to call a senior order member. This didn't sit very comfortably with me. You know, I'd gone as a baby order member and suddenly sort of people were seeing, I think anyone who takes a lot of responsibility in the order, you're suddenly a sort of senior order member. And I found sort of people projecting things onto me, and I always used to pride myself that, oh, people won't project onto me because I'm totally down to earth and sort of, but actually that, you know, that wasn't the case always. I didn't always find that easy, and I didn't always find living with people who were much newer to Buddhism and the FWBO very easy. You know, here if I see you all remember. I just wanted to sort of hang out with people more. There I've been, but I did move out and lived on my own, and actually for 10 years now I've been living on my own in Cambridge, which I love, but my life is very, very peopled. I was asked to become a preceptor to a number of women, which I have done and will continue to do, and at some point in the 2002-03, I can't remember now when, I was asked to become a public preceptor and a member of the College of Public Preceptors. And that's a mixed blessing. Mostly it's great. One of the main sort of aspects of our activity is sort of ensuring common standards of ordination worldwide. I love the people I work with in that. You know, people like Dharma Dinner, trying to think who else lives here, Malik, although she's sort of moving away from that now. Parami, I'm sure you all know. And then, you know, some of the guys, Dharmarati, Manju Vajra, who was right back, one of my early friends. My relationship with Bhante has changed over the years. From being very easygoing at the beginning, I went through some real difficulties with Bhante, which I haven't got the time to talk about now, but I sort of now feel that I'm at a place of ease with him. There's aspects of Bhante's character which I don't find entirely easy, but then his extraordinary wisdom and what he's done in setting up this movement and this order is so far-reaching. I don't think I understand it, really, and I don't think we will understand. I don't think our generation will. I think probably in 200-300 years' time we'll look back and we'll see what a place Bhante Sangharakshita has in the place of Buddhism in the West. I think we're too close to it, and too close maybe to the man and some of his characteristics, which some of us maybe find a little odd. Looking back on my life, do I have regrets? Well, as I say, life is full of regrets. And I'm sure there's many things I have done which I haven't felt entirely proud about, and it's often around aspects of communication or lack of communication. But overall, I do feel that my main life choices have been worthy and beneficial, and I feel fine about them. I have always worked in the movement since the late 70s. I'm not rich, wealth by wealth, but I do feel that I have a lot of inner riches, and I have many friends, and I do feel a lot of confidence, as in Shraddha confidence, faith confidence, in what we are achieving together and in the world. So just to sum up, I have never doubted Buddhism since that listening to that first lecture, Perfect Vision. I've never doubted Buddhism. I have had questions about the movement. There have been times when I've visited other Buddhist groups, that's mainly actually to talk about our work in India. And to me, what I felt they lacked was Sangha, or the kind of emphasis we have on Sangha in Triratna. We are so much more than the sum of our individual parts. And if I'd not found Buddhism, it's impossible to say. You know, I look at my friend Judith and I think, you know, some of that might have been me, but I really can't say. I don't feel isolated from the world. I feel very connected with the world, even though I'm working so much in the movement. I have a family, in that I've got a brother and a sister and my mum. I work in the College of Public Preceptors, as I said, with some fantastic men and women who have given their lives for the spread of the Dharma. And not only people in the college, it's many, many of my friends who are doing all sorts of different Dharma activities. To misquote Adrian Henry, who was one of the Liverpool poets, some of you might remember, of the late 60s, without Buddhism, that wasn't what he said, without Buddhism I'd probably have more money and time and nothing to do with them. So, people ask me sometimes about retirement. I've just got my bus pass. I don't think Buddhists really retire. I don't think you can. In a way, I think my life has gone in a particular direction, which it will continue to do till my death. In a way, perhaps I can just come back to the lines of acceptance that I said at my ordination, at my public ordination, which every order member will have said, which I want to continue to fulfill. And they are, with loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. For the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. and for the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. And that is what I would like to continue till my death, however that works its way out.